It's Friday, so we'll figure out what happened this week. We'll take a spin through the Chinese consumer economy, and we will hear from an Irish sheep farmer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 19th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I know Monday seems like a long time ago, always does come Friday afternoons of late, but that's where you got to start if you want to explain what happened the past 5 days, which is what we are going to do. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Rachel Abrams is with the New York Times. They are both in our New York studios. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey.
So, Lynette, let me start with you. We'll go back to Monday. The deficit figures from the Treasury Department up 17% from a year ago, $779 billion. It kind of seems that those numbers have lost all meaning, though they are big numbers.
Well, sort of. I mean, everyone told Republicans this was going to happen, and they did it anyway. It, you know, the deficit is the difference between how much we're spending and how much we're collecting, yes, and how that continuously grows. For some reason, conservatives have managed to convince Americans that if we collect less money, we'll have more money, mm-hmm, against all logic. So now everyone's in the Republican Party is saying we might have to cut entitlements because, mm-hmm, now we have this crazy deficit and all more money is going to go to interest payments. We can't have this. But everybody told them from the beginning that this is how it was going to look. And it's just sad that we have this kind of weird cognitive dissonance going on.
It bears a mention here, not for the first time on this radio program, Rachel Abrams, that tax cuts have never paid for themselves.
Right. So I think that that's sort of the great irony in all of this is that the tax cuts that the GOP pushed through, which primarily benefited, or I guess you should say benefited corporations, mm-hmm, and very wealthy individuals the most, that in order to pay for those tax cuts, you have Mitch McConnell talking about surprise, mm-hmm, cuts to entitlement programs. And I think that kind of goes back to the question of, well, why do we care about the national debt? Why do we care about the deficit? It, when you spend increasingly more and more and more money, you have the calls to get rid of entitlement programs like Medicare, Social Security, that kind of stuff. Those calls get louder and louder and louder because because the Republicans are going to be at least right now advocating more for businesses, right, than for those programs.
So the cynical person might say, this is what they wanted to do from the beginning was make it necessary to shrink the federal government.
We're not cynical, though.
Let's be clear. Paul Ryan said this going on a year ago now, right, that entitlements were the next thing. But, Rachel, let me continue with completely foreseeable circumstances that now appear on our national horizon. There was news this week of more trade unrest. Wilbur Ross was in Europe complaining about the European trade deals. The Chinese now, that is another thing that has seemingly heated up again with Larry Kudlow saying things. But we got hard numbers from BMW down in South Carolina. These tariffs are going to cost them $500 million a year. It's not like nobody knew this was coming.
Yeah, and I think especially going into the midterms, people are really wondering, how is this going to affect really hotly contested races? You have soybean farmers in Iowa that were really, mm-hmm, concerned, mm-hmm, about the price of their crops going down because of the trade war. President Trump announced that he was going to be providing $12 billion in, yeah, aid to farmers that are hurt by the trade war, which hopefully will help boost some of his core constituents. So essentially, we are subsidizing a trade war perhaps to help the Republican Party in the midterms. Who knows?
Right before we sat down here, Mattel announced that it was going to have layoffs. So yep. Ford has already announced they're going to do layoffs. So
okay.
Not a lot of happy Americans there.
But wait a second. Because, and the president says this on the stump all the time, the economy's doing great. Unemployment's low. We got corporate profits this week, Lynette, from the banks, which are making gazillions of dollars. What's not to like?
Well, except for some one-time charges and those tax benefits, or then benefit from those tax cuts, actually, their balance sheets are looking pretty shabby, which means that the regular business of lending to Americans who can afford to pay back those, mm-hmm, loans is not doing so hot, which is an indicator that maybe things aren't going as well as people are saying. Wage growth continues to be pretty slow, and it also indicates that probably over the next quarter, if they don't have those one-time charges, we're going to see a much uglier quarter, and the stock market's probably going to react pretty badly to that. So enjoy the fun while it lasts.
On that market thing, Rachel, and I don't want to go too far into this, but it's interesting the volatility that has come back in the last, 2 weeks now, and we haven't seen it for a very long time.
Yes. And it's really interesting because the president has taken a lot of credit when we've seen surges in the market. He has blamed his predecessors when we have seen dips. I think a lot of people, a lot of economists and financial and business experts would agree that the stock markets are not particularly good indicators of the economy overall. But we're definitely going into the midterms. Anytime we do see a surge, we are going to see the president probably promote mm-hmm. what he's done over the past year.
And these are dramatic falls, like 1,000 points. Ugly stuff. Yeah. And of course, Trump used to tweet that if that happened, a president should be fired Obama administration.
There is a tweet.
As always, there's a tweet.
There is a tweet for everything. Lynette, you get the last word. You got 20 seconds to do it. Just really quickly, the Fed minutes this week and Jay Powell basically saying, everything's fine. We're going to keep raising rates. Everybody stay calm.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason for him not to change course. I think the stock market, again, is not the economy, and President Trump should have absolutely nothing to say about the Fed. So there's actually no reason for Jerome Powell to change course. It's not in his data, and the stock market should not be something that he's worried about. In fact, what the Fed is probably looking at is popping a bubble in stocks.
Oh, and somebody's phone went off? Seriously, you guys, you've been doing this for a long time now. Turn your phones off in the studio. Lynette Lopez at Business Insider, Rachel Abrams at the New York Times. It's Friday. Bye.
Bye.
Wall Street Today was a little of this and a little of that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Corporate story of the day today is brought to us by the letters P and G, as in the consumer products conglomerate Procter & Gamble. This morning, the company posted its best quarterly sales growth in 5 years, which comes after years of basically no growth. Everything was up: razor blades, laundry detergent, healthcare products too. But the real driver of this thing was bathing and beauty and booming global demand, which is helping the old established brands and the upstarts as well, as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports from WESA in Pittsburgh.
Procter & Gamble's Gillette, Pantene, Olay, we grew up with those brands. They were available in just about every store. That actually hurt those brands' ability to grow. Younger shoppers want smaller batch, organic, newer products. Ravi Dar runs the Center for Customer Insights at Yale University. The familiar products?
They were not seen as authentic by millennials.
So the big brands took note, says Michael Solomon, marketing professor at St. Joseph's University. And now?
They're highlighting the natural aspects of existing products where in the past that wouldn't have been part of their appeal. So it's not that they're doing anything different with the product. They're just
marketing tired brands with a fresh face, adding a Gillette subscription shave club and a makeover for a core product, Olay, says Sucharita Kadali, a retail analyst at Forrester Research.
They've essentially reintroduced the brand, I think, to younger generations with that. And, you know, maybe it's finally caught up.
So it's working, helping a legacy company like Procter & Gamble compete against smaller boutique brands and other similar bargain-priced competition. P&G posted a $10 billion profit last year under pressure from an activist investor concerned that wasn't enough. Now the company's trimmed back on marketing costs by 6%, and their Gillette Shave Club is going strong. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
We learned this morning that the Chinese economy grew by a mere 6.5% in its latest quarter, and I appreciate the double take you just did upon hearing me say mere, because 6.5% economic growth, am I right? But it is the lowest growth Beijing has reported since the Great Recession. And you might be tempted to blame the current trade malaise with the United States for that happening. But as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from Washington, things are a little more complicated and a little more domestic over there than you might think.
To many, China has a self-induced economic hangover. It indulged for years in overborrowing and overbuilding, and now comes the morning after, says Carmen Reinhart. She teaches international finance at Harvard.
A hangover of infrastructure projects that ex post low rates of return or negative rates of return and the debt associated with those projects as well.
And now from the outside comes another headache: American taxes on Chinese exports. Ishwar Prasad is professor of trade policy and economics at Cornell.
The concern is that China is now dealing with the fallout of an expanding trade war with the U.S. at a time when domestic economic indicators are losing some momentum.
The trade war pain may not show up in Chinese numbers yet, and some think the direct effects may be small. That's compared to the effects of souring sentiment about China. That would really hurt. Already, investors in mainland stocks and currency are fleeing, says Peter Donasanu of the Wells Fargo Investment Institute.
If folks aren't getting out there and investing or spending, then that will then reinforce a sort of a negative feedback loop, and then it goes on and on.
China's not the only question mark in the emerging world. Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey, South Africa, they all have issues, which means to Cornell's Ishwar Prasad, the emerging markets are no longer a big driver of global growth.
Now the U.S. is growing quite strongly and leading the pack. The rest of the advanced economies are also doing not too badly. But the emerging markets as a group do seem to be having a much tougher time.
That's just in time for trade war uncertainty everywhere. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
With the caveat that it ain't over until it's over, and apologies to Yogi Berra, too, I guess, on that one. There is news of possible, and I stress here, possible progress on the last big sticking point in the Brexit negotiations. Bloomberg is reporting that there might be a deal on the future state of the Irish border with Northern Ireland. Ireland, that is, the Irish border, being the only EU country that shares a land border with Great Britain, of which Northern Ireland is a part. Leaving the negotiations to the politicians, our concern is how things feel on the ground, the basic premise of our series, My Economy. Today's installment, which comes from our colleagues at the BBC, comes from a sheep farmer in Northern Ireland, hard by that Irish border.
My name is James Johnson, and I work for Ulster Farmers Mart, which is a family business in the town of Enniskillen. We run a livestock sales business, mainly cattle and sheep. We're right on the border, so there's certainly a lot of confusion, a lot of uncertainty around Brexit. Is very different to what's being portrayed in the media. There's free movement across the border, and I think just the general consensus, whether somebody's voted to leave or voted to remain, they're all united in terms of just keeping that freedom of movement. We deal with farmers who are customers, and they have land on both sides of the border. So in one field, they've got cattle and sheep that are registered to a Northern Ireland farm. Literally the other side of the fence, they've got cattle and sheep that are registered to a Republic of Ireland farm. And it's of paramount importance that those farmers can go about their daily business. They would be crossing the border several times a day. Personally, I was for Brexit. I just feel that the European Union, as it currently is just taking more and more authority and more power. And I think to have your own autonomy and your own freedom outside of those constraints would be a positive thing in the longer term. But also we would have other farmers and quite a number of sheep farmers who would very much feel that it's beneficial to stay within Europe and to be part of the same regulations and the same rules, because it makes trade easier. Speaking to people more grassroots level, the consensus is that there will be some sort of deal, that it won't be left to a no deal. Reasonable minds will get together and get something put in place, but certainly it's very much in people's minds, and just the uncertainty and the whole question of what's going to happen, especially with the border, is something that people are thinking about constantly and very much concerned about.
We can't do this series without your help, so please do take a second to tell us how your economy is doing. There's a spot you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
It's kind of like a thing where Facebook says jump and publishers say, okay, how high?
Yeah, but most of them jumped a little bit too high. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 64 points on this Friday, 0.2%, closed at 25,444. The NASDAQ down 36, that's 0.4%, 7449. The S&P 500 basically flat, 2767. For the week, the Dow found 0.4% somehow. The NASDAQ gained 1.6%. The S&P 500 mostly unchanged. We heard from Erica Barris earlier about Procter & Gamble's strong quarter thanks to big sales in beauty products. Shares up 8.8% today. Morgan Stanley downgraded Ford Motor stock. Morgan Stanley cited limited progress from Ford's restructuring. But maybe a new ad campaign from Bryan Cranston, a.k.a. Walter White of Breaking Bad, will help. I don't know. I never saw that program, actually. Ford lost 0.1% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Tino. Don't at me, man. 10-year Treasury rose to 3.19%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. Do me a favor, check out a podcast I host with Molly Wood. It's called Make Me Smart. Every week, we connect the dots on all things tech, economic, and culture. And this week, we're going to get smart about smart homes and what that might mean for your privacy.
The thing that it comes down to is there a market out there for the data? Does anybody want to buy from Nest how frequently people's air conditioning turns on and off? Who is that data valuable to?
That expert, by the way, was actually one of our listeners because, as we like to say on this podcast, none of us is as smart as all of us. Check it out. Make Me Smart. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Back to China, we are going to go now. Scott was telling us up earlier in the program about how the second biggest economy in the world is slowing just a little bit, and that's even before you take count of the trade war. But as Scott alluded to, and over the past couple of months, there's a phrase that Jennifer Pack, our correspondent in Shanghai, has been seeing and hearing a lot, something called a consumption downgrade. Possibly worrying, one might imagine, for American companies selling into that Chinese market. Here's Jennifer.
Douglas Yan is exactly what China's economy needs, a spender. Or a spender like he used to be. The IT supervisor who works for a Danish company near Shanghai says he loved to shop on the popular e-commerce platform JD.com.
I bought home appliances, food, and cell phones. I used to buy almost everything except clothes on JD.com.
On that one e-commerce site alone, he spent at least $14,000 last year. But now, Yan thinks twice before buying.
Now I just buy stuff that I need, and only if it's on sale.
And the reason? He's focusing on necessities like furnishings for a new apartment and insurance for his family. That leaves him with less money to splurge on other things. Yan says he's on a, quote, consumption downgrade. Here's how he defines it.
It's like if I bought an iPhone last year, but now I can only afford to buy a cheaper Chinese brand like Xiaomi.
Across China, the talk is about cutting back in big ways and small, from restaurants to fast food, from taxis to shared bicycles. This catchy tune is an ad for e-commerce platform Pinduoduo. It gives group discounts on cheap goods, and it's rivaling giants like JD.com and Alibaba's Taobao. Other firms selling low-end products like instant noodles and pickled mustard greens have reported soaring profits. Could these be signs of China shoppers becoming more frugal?
I don't think there's any significant evidence that this is a big macro story.
Nicholas Lardy is an economist with the Peterson Institute in Washington. He says retail sales data recently did show slower than expected growth, but that's only focused on goods. He says spending on services went up, plus wages are increasing.
With incomes rising and the savings rate going down, that's a very powerful combination for sustaining fairly strong growth of consumption.
Many economists agree with him. So, if it's not showing up in the data, then why is there so much talk about consumption downgrade? Lardy says Chinese citizens may be picking up a larger narrative in the U.S. that China's economy is slowing down.
And the implication seems to be that China will be very vulnerable to the tariffs that President Trump has imposed on Chinese goods sold in the United States.
Others say the talk of a consumption downgrade is rooted in rising home prices. Fu Yifu is with the Suning Institute of Finance in Beijing. He says people must borrow more to pay for a home, and mortgages make up the bulk of China's household debt.
From 2008 to 2017, China's ratio of household debt to GDP went from 18 to 50%. That's a 32-point increase in less than 10 years, whereas it took a few decades for that to happen in the U.S.
He says that makes people anxious, and psychology plays a big role in consumption. Just ask David Wilder, managing editor with Financial Times Confidential Research. Each month, his firm surveys consumers in China.
What we've seen in the last few months is a shift in their desire to invest over saving, where consumption is actually held relatively flat. I think what it tells us is that consumers are getting nervous.
Nervous about China's stock market taking a dive, the government reining in debt, and the trade dispute with the U.S. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
It's been a complicated couple of years for Facebook in this economy, also for mainstream media. Both are being criticized by politicians, some politicians anyway, and by the public to some degree as well. But journalism and Facebook have a weird symbiotic relationship, too. Publishers need Facebook to get their content out, and Facebook needs that content to get users. And a court filing this week shed some new light on a key part of that relationship, the part that has come to be called the pivot to video. Maya Kossoff wrote about it for Vanity Fair. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So back a couple of years ago, April 2016, Mark Zuckerberg says, we are pivoting to video at Facebook, and journalism does what?
Journalism pivots with it,
yeah,
basically.
And they say, listen, we have to be in this space. We're going to hire a bunch of video producers. And yet now we learn through this lawsuit that maybe it didn't work out so well.
Right. So, I think for publishers, this was kind of a sunken cost fallacy. They've already invested a lot of resources in Facebook. They see Facebook kind of eating into their traffic. So when Facebook says we're pivoting to video, it's kind of like a thing where Facebook says jump and publishers say, okay, how high?
Yeah.
And so they invest all these resources into doing video. And then in 2016 and 2017, you kind of saw these layoffs where entire editorial teams were being restructured to eliminate writers and hire video producers. So this happened at places like MTV News. It happened at Vocative, Mike.com, Mashable, right. You name it. It probably happened there.
All right. So we'll get to the layoffs thing in a minute. But the reason it's germane is that very quickly after this started, Facebook said, wait, these video figures aren't as impressive as we thought. And now we've learned from this lawsuit this week, not only were they less impressive than thought, they were just flat wrong by a lot.
Yeah. You have this small group of advertisers with this lawsuit basically saying that Facebook inflated the numbers by, in some cases, allegedly up to 900%. Mm-hmm. So entirely different story than what we thought we were seeing with these video view counts.
Part of the problem here, it seems to me, is that nobody's checking Facebook's math, as it were. They keep their own numbers. They tell us what was going on, and media and journalism react as opposed to having some objective measure of whether or not these things are working, these videos.
Sure. I mean, I think that everybody, there's a lot of blame to go around here, right? Obviously, Facebook is to blame, but also advertisers and publishers maybe aren't doing their own homework and aren't keeping tabs on the numbers as closely as they should have been. It seems like publishers were a little bit credulous. They were definitely desperate for a new revenue stream. And there definitely wasn't any checking going on here in terms of the numbers.
So even besides the numbers, though, one has to point out that publishers, as you sort of mentioned, they jumped right in here and they made those transitions in the newsroom. People were laid off. Organizations were changed and, I'm sorry to use this word, pivoted because of what Facebook said to do.
Yeah. I mean, again, it was kind of a case where obviously media is in dire straits and publishers are looking for new revenue sources. And they see this video thing that Facebook is doing and they think this could be it. And they kind of just jumped in with both feet.
What does Facebook have to say for itself?
Not a whole lot. It is obviously refuting the fraud claims in the lawsuit right now. It did. Obviously, it took some accountability in 2016 mm-hmm. when these discrepancies kind of first emerged publicly. But I mean, Facebook is kind of maintaining that it didn't do anything wrong.
Mm-hmm. And we should say this matter is still pending in court and everybody's going to have their day, right?
Absolutely.
Maya Kossoff, she's a tech writer at Vanity Fair. Maya, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am sorry to be the one to have to tell you, but you don't stand a chance. I mean, yes, somebody is going to win, but the odds are overwhelming that it ain't going to be you, or me, for that matter. The official odds of one person winning the billion-dollar Mega Millions lottery prize drawing tonight is 1 in 302 million. But look, if it is you, first of all, by all means, consult your own financial professional. But two other things. Please remember your local public radio station and this program, and also take the cash option, will you? All right, we got to go. It's Friday. Dow Industrial's up 64 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 36 points, 0.4%. S&P 500 basically flat. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday. Have a good weekend out there, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.